I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, August 27th, and as we record this episode in the early evening, global cases of coronavirus now stand at over 24.25 million around the world. Deaths have exceeded 827,000. That's over 3 million more cases since our last episode was recorded a fortnight ago, and over 75,000 more people who have died in that time. Here in Ireland, the Department of Health has confirmed there have been 93 more cases of COVID-19 confirmed to them over the last 24 hours and no new deaths. It brings the total number of cases here to nearly 28,500, up nearly 1,500 in the last fortnight. The number of coronavirus-related deaths in that time is up 3 to 1,777. Now, this evening we learned that the public health advice is not to open the pubs on Monday, and the advice is also not to lift restrictions currently in place in County Kildare, restrictions with which the world has become familiar, listener, as they contributed in no small part to the undoing of European Commissioner Phil Hogan. Those restrictions also apply to me, so you'll forgive me if for this one episode I take this podcast virtually out of a rainy, restricted Kildare and go west. No, not to Clifton, but further west to the US. New York, to be precise, to look at how COVID is making history, or rather how an oral history project is recording the experiences of Irish immigrants, old and new, as they cope with the coronavirus. In a departure from its usual format, this episode will be looking at the fascinating work of the Irish Studies programme at Queen's College, City University of New York, whose researchers began collecting COVID-related interviews as part of their ongoing oral history project on Irish emigrants living in the borough of Queens, the epicentre of the COVID epicentre, as its director described it to me. Now, I've been talking to the aforementioned director, Sarah Covington, and researchers Eileen Sprague, Claire Butler and Liza Engesser, who've been talking me through just a very small sample of their recordings, which are being heard publicly here for the first time on this podcast. But first, a round of introductions.
My name is Claire Butler. I'm from Ennis, County Clare. I was living in New York for 5 months and before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And I was working on the Irish in New York Oral History Project, working on basic audio editing, finding interviewees and helping out with the social media and helping out at events as well.
Hi, my name is Liza Engesser and I work on the Irish in New York Oral History Project at Queen's College. I became involved first when I took a course while I was completing my Irish Studies minor at Queen's College, and I've been working on it for the past year. Sarah and Eileen had invited me to conduct further interviews and also help with the social media and at events as well.
I'm Eileen Collarin Sprague. I'm from Woodside, Queens, in New York. My parents immigrated here in 1950. And when I heard Sarah's idea to do an oral history after a lecture that she hosted, I jumped on board because it meant a lot to me to record the memories, especially of the elderly Irish in Queens. So that's what I focused on from the start.
Okay, so Sarah, tell us who you are, what your job is, and give us a brief overview of the Oral History Project and how it came into being.
My name is Sarah Covington, and I'm a professor of British and Irish history at Queen's College, City University of New York, and I became director of Irish Studies 5 years ago. It's a 45-year-old program, so one of the oldest programs in the country. And when I came on with Eileen, we decided to start an oral history project of Irish immigrants in the borough of Queens, which was a very, very intensely Irish community. It's now fading a bit. So we wanted to capture the stories of working, primarily working class, you know, everyday Irish in the borough of Queens, on as that identity is sort of fading from that area. So Eileen and I have directed these interviews, and then COVID hit and the oral history project took a very different turn.
All right, it was quite a nimble reaction then to go from a long-term project on the experiences of various ages of immigrants, and particularly obviously get the elderly while the elderly are still able to give their testimony. But when COVID yes. comes along, is it because it affected the elderly in particular, or did you just pivot to it because you were seeing there was an Irish experience you wanted to capture that was unique in COVID?
Yeah, well, when COVID hit, and as with everywhere, as in Ireland as well, everything came to a halt. And the way it hit in New York City was very sudden. It started with one case in New Rochelle, which is a suburb north of here, and then it exponentially exploded in the city. And it was terrifying, actually, to live here. I live in Manhattan in the East Village, and many people fled. So you had the kind of sight of empty streets and constant sirens. And there was actually a mobile morgue 7 blocks north of where I live. And I think it's hard for us to kind of get back into the direct memory of how scary it was here in New York. And it was bad enough where I lived, but everyone knew that the epicenter was Queens. So Eileen and all of us, Liza and Claire and I, were having a Zoom meeting, and we decided to capture the experiences and testimonies of all our cohort of older and younger who lived right in the center of what was happening. And we interviewed them a bit later on, not directly as things were unfolding, but there was still a lot of fear at the time. Many people I know say that it was in many ways much worse than 9/11. And of course you can't compare, but it was a very different kind of experience of death. I mean, we have, I think, well over 200,000 cases of COVID in New York City. We've lost about 30,000 lives to COVID. About 7,000 of those lives lost were in Queens. So Queens and Brooklyn are neck and neck as being the boroughs of New York City that were hit the hardest. And so we wanted to tap into our interviewees and see how they were doing through all of this.
So I'm going to start with you first, Claire Butler from County Clare, but currently I think resident in Mayo. So you had the experience of getting out of New York when COVID hit, and the interviewee you've picked from the many interviews you've done is Amy, who is a bartender, who to a certain degree had the same experience as you. So just very briefly before we hear her, how did you contact her? How did you find her?
I actually got in touch with Amy through another interviewee. Her name was Dee Ennis, and she was interviewed a couple of times as part of the Irish in New York Oral History Project. And she gave me her contact details and told me that Amy had returned to Ireland very early on, in like mid-March, with a group of other bartenders, and that she'd be open to being interviewed.
Right, so let's have a listen to Amy, who had to get out very quickly, as we'll hear in this clip.
When they announced on the Sunday that they were closing the bars on the St. Paddy's Day, which was the 17th, we booked that Monday morning, which was the 16th, and we flew Monday night. And we were lucky as well now. So 5 of us came back together. One of the girls that traveled back, her parents actually own a house in Cavan. We were lucky we were able to stay in that house for 2 weeks rent free. But I know a good people who have just an apartment sitting there, like just eating into their savings. Like I'd nearly say, like, out of my friends, it'd be like 60-40, and that 60 stayed and 40 left. But even like the 60 that stayed, is some of them that if they leave, they won't be able to get back. And then I also know people who came back who won't be able to go back to New York, which I think is such a commitment, and like so brave of them, and fair play to them. Like, that's tough. So, but now saying that, like, a few of my friends say we came in March, and then a few came at the start of May, where they're like, okay, this actually isn't getting any better. I think a lot of people were kind of like trying to ride it out at the start, and they're like, it's not going to be that bad. But my friend got an email basically telling all of them to go get another job. They were like, it's not going to be the same when it opens, and we're looking at probably July, and even then it's going to be completely different to what we were doing. It's only going to be to go orders. We won't need half the that. We got a letter, which was like a very official, when it first all went down, basically saying that the bar was closing and that we all still had a job to go back to when the bar reopened. I actually had my 5-year anniversary 2 days ago. Spent it in Mayo, like the irony of it all. So that's home now, though. It's great. Like, look, it's great to be home in Ireland and like having the crack, whatever. But I hate to like come home now because I feel like it's very hard to like wrap up your New York life just like that. And you can't even say a proper goodbye. Like, you can't even really meet your friends for a drink or anything. It just ends. There's so much of your life is in New York, especially when you've been there 5 years. I moved over when I was 22, 27 now. So I feel like a lot of your growing up was done there. So it'd be awful to lose that, like not be able to end the chapter, as they say.
So Claire, that was Amy. Amy was working as a bartender and she was talking about some of her friends staying and some of her friends going. So did the project capture some of the people who stayed, or was it just, did you manage to get who you could get and talk to Amy?
Yeah, I think it was more a case of we just managed to get who we could get, and we just heard from Amy out of that group. But she did say that another group of her friends that had decided to stay on actually returned to Ireland then in May, and many of them had no visa, so they actually couldn't return to New York afterwards. So they were leaving their whole lives behind.
And would that have been the typical motivation of people who decided to stay, that simply had they left, there was no return to the life they'd built for themselves in New York?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them, like, you know, didn't know how long this whole thing was going to go on for. So they said they'd stay and ride it out for a couple of weeks. But as the whole thing progressed and things were getting worse and worse, they just felt that they wanted to get out of New York. And I think another motivation for people leaving New York as well, even if they had a visa or not, was just the fear of the cost of healthcare over there. If they did happen to become sick and have to be hospitalized, not many of them had health insurance and wouldn't be able to cover the costs over there.
So when it comes to then, obviously you're dealing with a broader sweep of people across the age groups. There are obviously the people who decided to stay. So maybe Eileen will go to you and get a sense of how the retirees were feeling. How strong is the community? What's the sense of the Irish community amongst the elderly? Is there a large social scene amongst older Irish people? And when the COVID message hit, did it become a talking point that kind of spread through them in a viral way because of a close social network? Or are they a more isolated community?
I think that it's both. I think there is a strong level of activity among many elderly Irish. And of course, all of those activities they were used to were curtailed with the pandemic. So one of my concerns was the loneliness factor, because people were suddenly sequestered, having very little contact. It came across in many of the interviews. What people were missing was everything from, you know, the churchgoers missed church, and the people who went to Cayley's or were accustomed to going to pubs, to music events or theater events or anything like that. Everything came to a standstill. But in addition to that, a recurring message for me, something I enjoyed very much about these telephone interviews, was a consistent message of resilience and optimism, that people, however alone they might be, made efforts to reach out to family and friends, doing drive-bys with their grandchildren, being sure to stay in touch with people both here in New York and in Ireland, wherever their family might be. So that part was it was great for me personally to hear again and again people saying, we'll get through this, we'll make the best of it, we're doing the best we can, this too shall pass kind of message.
Which is a good point for us to hear from Catherine. So before we hear from her briefly, who is Catherine, what's her background, and how did you contact her?
Okay, so I've made a lot of my contacts through word of mouth in Woodside, and through family and friends. That's how the whole project came to be initially. We did a little outreach in the community. We hosted a few events. And, you know, we asked people if they wanted to share their memories, that it was important for us to preserve them and protect them, and that we were interested. And word got around and people started talking about it and responding to our efforts. So I initially interviewed her about 5.5 years ago, and an additional interview after that, probably 3 years ago. She's a retired office manager. She emigrated here from Donegal shortly after World War II, when she was 19 years old, came to Sunnyside, spent most of her life in the Sunnyside Woodside area. She's just a delightful person who was always so happy to share her life experiences with us.
All right, let's hear from her now.
The first time that I felt it was St. Patrick's Day in Sunnyside, between the boarded stores, and this was before the lockdown, I saw one lady with green arms, and it got me very depressed. I had such beautiful memories of St. Patrick's Day and everything alive and going, and I can't go and have a cup of coffee. I better go home. I walked up to 46th Street to get the bus, and there was a man singing American-Irish song. He was singing Rosie O'Grady, two others. And I saw the 60 bus coming in the distance, and I thought, okay, hop on the 60 bus, go home. And then there was no celebration, there was no nothing. But I was very fortunate. I had to call from England, Ireland, and I called them. Everybody's in the same boat. After a while, there's nothing to talk about. Now, that part of it was very good. But it's still, it's a sad time. It's getting back to St. Patrick's Day when I went into Kiefer. And I saw the empty shelves. It brought me back to Ireland during World War II. And very little, and the elderly people could not understand. They had the money why you couldn't buy it. So they used to send us kids to the store. And the storekeepers would get the frustration on us. What are you coming here asking for that for? You know we don't have it.
As you said in advance, I mean, she's quite the optimistic character, and despite having a very bad St. Patrick's Day, she ends up seeing the very much the bright side of it. And she concludes comparing it to her experience during World War II. As you said, she left Ireland shortly after that, saying that when the shops got emptied, it reminded her of rationing and the ire that she got running messages for older people in Donegal. But from comparing it to that, then we had Tom, who was likening this general surreality of COVID to 9/11. It's a short clip we have of the interview, but tell us about Tom and how you contacted him and what his backstory is.
So Tom McGuire, I interviewed he and his wife about 5 years ago. He was a longtime parishioner of St. Sebastian's Church in Woodside, a hub of Irish and Irish American life for many, many years. And again, a willing participant, a frequent attendee at our events in the community. And I just had to reach out to him during this collection of these pandemic stories because I wanted to know how he and his wife were faring and what their experience was like. He's a retired building engineer, did the job for about 40 years. I think he's retired about 8 years now. So it definitely would have been in his mind, having worked in Manhattan his whole career, to compare it to 9/11. And he wasn't the only one. That seemed to be a little touchstone in a way. But again, a message of resilience and missing their grandchildren, but making the best of it. And knowing that this is going to pass by and we're going to be okay after it.
Right. So let's hear from Tom now.
We didn't appreciate all the freedoms we had now until we have to do things different. Yeah, the only thing that I experienced was 9/11. I remember I was working nights and I came home from work and I'm reading the newspaper and I saw the planes on the television hitting the Twin Towers. That was a pretty bad time, but this is worse, you know. This is going to last much longer, you know. Well, hopefully, you know, not too much longer. But it's difficult. We're used to doing things certain ways and we have to change, you know. We're not maybe following all the rules, but we're doing the best we can. We don't like wearing these masks and all that stuff, but you have to do it if you go out and we run to the store and we get home fast and we miss our grandkids. We're not getting the opportunity to get a hug or a shake hands anymore. It's just, you know, seeing them from a distance or the modern technology. Modern phones, watch them or something like that. We miss that a lot.
So that's some of the retirees you've spoken to. Liza, we've gone from people who've been dealing with the older members of the community to somebody who's been dealing with the very young, and that's Idel, a grade school teacher. But, I mean, she had to innovate pretty quickly. Obviously, the young people she's dealing with are not by any means exclusively Irish-American, but she brings a very caring, very pastoral approach to her work as a teacher, very open 24/7. Give us a bit of her backstory before we hear from her.
Edel Bolin, she immigrated here from Port Arlington, County Leash in 1993. She's a teacher who lives in Woodlawn, Bronx. She teaches fourth grade. She's just amazing. I think she's a great teacher, very positive person, very helpful towards her students, very supportive. And it was, you know, this was a huge challenge for teachers transitioning to online at every level. They had to do it in such a short period of time, trying to keep your students engaged and stuff like that. She really did a great job of that and being supportive to a child who lost their father during COVID. And
let's have a listen to her now and all of the innovations she was forced into by COVID.
One is forced to slow down and take in nature and begin the gifts that we take for granted on a daily basis. We are kind, we are compassionate, and we care for each other. That's our classroom mantra. I lost a father of one of my students. That posed significant challenges trying to support the mom. I would text her every day, I would call her every day, just to try and enable her in some way to use our tech support, have the child on Google Classroom, so that he could see us and he could be with us. And that, thankfully, we managed to make happen. So that's a successful part of something very tragic. They all have my cell phone number, and I wouldn't have it any other way. These are unprecedented times, and people are struggling, and people are very fragile, and they just want to pick up the phone and talk. So be it. We decided that we would do a virtual tea party, because we're just keeping it very human. So anyway, they constantly ask me if they can see my teapots. Decided, right. So last Friday afternoon, we did a virtual tea party together. At the end of the day, they saw the teapot, a cup and saucer, the milk jug, and then they told me, but Miss Boland, we must have crumpet too. What a tea party. It was just hysterical. It was hysterical. Oh, as they were sharing their work, they were donning their special hat and drinking their tea. It was precious. Yeah.
So that was Edel Bolin, their grade school teacher, as you say, teaching fourth grade. Just what age is fourth grade for the benefit of Irish people who are not familiar? Maybe
9 years old.
9 years, okay. The difference between the older community you're trying to capture and the younger community, I mean, to what extent are the younger people a community, or does that contrast in any way with the older people? Are the same social networks there, or are young people more coming to New York as individuals and maybe perhaps not as connected as their forebears were?
Yeah, well, I could say that, you know, when I interviewed Nick Cohen, the bar owner, he said he came with just a visa and he had one cousin here. And then I was so impressed by his drive, his determination as an Irish immigrant. And, he was able to open a club in the 90s, a nightclub. And I mean, I think the younger generation somewhat are less connected, but the social media does help us definitely recruit people. Nick Cohen, I found through social media.
Tell us about Nick Cohen, what his background is.
I really enjoyed interviewing Nick Cohen. I did an oral history with him and also the COVID comments. And I think he just gave a great description of what business owners are going through in New York City, especially in Manhattan. He came here from Dublin in 1993. It was so interesting to me that he started in sales. Like, he started in sales for Sam Adams beer, and then he was able to open a nightclub. He reached out to us through Facebook. Like I said, he gave a wonderful description of how businesses are struggling right now. He's still, obviously his businesses are indoors, so he can't open them. They're still closed since March. I think he closed right before St. Patrick's Day. But he was also very positive and resilient too, and hopeful that he could bring his businesses back, after this. And I think he's still trying. I still see him posting on Facebook, like, we need indoor dining. It's, it's really hard to see people losing their livelihood and losing their jobs, and, which has been the case so much in this community.
Right. Well, why don't we hear from him?
So my bars are both in the Garment District on 37th Street in the middle of Manhattan, right by Madison Square Garden, Penn Station, the Hammerstein Ballroom, Times Square, you name it. They're large capacity places. They both hold over 250 people. I need the Javits Center to be having the car show and the concerts at the garden. Without that, even before the mandate on March 13th, we actually closed a huge St. Patrick's Day party that we do every year, cancelled. A lot of other cancellations, unfortunately, laying off 50 people plus 50 families. You know, I just hope that we can come back. Running a bar, the margins were so tight already before this. You know, maybe we'll make it till the end of the year. It just, we have to see what happens with the vaccine and social distancing and everything. Well, obviously, we'll abide by whatever guidelines and sanitation and, you know, cleanliness, and we'll do all of that. Masks, we'll do whatever we need to get back up and give all those people their jobs back. Let's just hope the customers are willing to come back. The city can get some life back into it. I mean, it's particularly hard, but I'm trying not to dwell on it. I lost my club on September 11th, you know, hoping I don't lose my bars with COVID-19, but I'm going to do my utmost to keep them, get them back up and running. And I mean, it's been nearly 3 months already. I am over it, but good citizen, and I'll do what I'm told. I'm working a lot with the restaurant industry and trying to do the alfresco dining, trying to help the whole industry as well as myself with some help from the city.
So Sarah first, and then maybe Eileen, if you want to come in on this, what happens to the oral history project? I mean, is it an archive from which you'll be drawing articles? What do you do with the audio, for example? How will this be drawn on, and what kind of level of interest to look into it is there already in terms of research by students in the university?
Well, we're archiving all the interviews in the Queen's College Library. So it will be an archive for future sociologists, urban studies people, historians. But we are, as Liza mentioned, we're very much legally protected. So we had to undertake a lot of sort of legal training and protection, because our subjects may not want to share their stories. And so we have them all very legally protected. Right. So not all the interviews are accessible to the public. It's determined according to what they want.
And why would that have been important, just a matter of interest? Is it because you wanted to capture the experience of people who were illegal immigrants as well as legal immigrants, and that, you know, you would get a more accurate picture if somebody could open up and speak to you about their status without fearing the long arm of the law, I suppose?
It was that, and also their personal history, and a lot of the details that have been shared are not details that someone would maybe want to have projected onto Facebook or the website. I'm thinking of one interview a number of the interviews do share trauma in their personal lives. So there is that sort of public-private tension, and we're very careful to, even if they want us to turn off the tape or delete great parts of the interview, that's their right. And we've learned from other oral history projects, the International Review Board is a very big ethical body in this country, and it's very legalistic in protecting the rights of our subjects. And we take care of that too. So if our interviews do go up on a website or in a podcast or whatever, it's all with the permission of the interviewees.
Did you find then, Eileen, when you were talking to maybe some of the older migrants, that when you checked in with them about their experience, that it gave them a lift, that they enjoyed talking about it, that maybe, you know, you heard them seeing the bright side as they spoke to you, or were they all pretty naturally optimistic people who are that way inclined anyway?
I'd say they are naturally optimistic by and large. Everyone's just dying to have a cup of tea with me or anyone else who might be able to visit them live and in person. And I can't wait to do the same. That was a big part of the experience. It was tough to replicate that level of intimacy over the phone. You know, people are happy to have someone to talk to, but there's nothing like that face-to-face connection that was a really integral part of the oral history project experience. I miss it, and they have expressed the same to me. Yeah, I think a lot of it, that message of hope and that certainty that we'll get through it, was an ongoing theme That was my experience with the interviews I did during the pandemic.
Right.
I think, if I can jump in, a common refrain, though, among our subjects is, why do you want to interview me? You know, I'm not famous, I'm not accomplished, or, you know, there's this reticence at first. And then, what, as Eileen said, once they start talking, they start talking. But to me, their lives are actually a lot more interesting and reflect a lot of accomplishment in building the city and being part of the best part of the city, I think.
And as an oral history project yourselves, I mean, how affected have you been by COVID? How did you have to pivot and change your work practices? I mean, obviously, I'll go to you on this, Claire. I mean, when are you expecting to return, if at all, to New York? Or when can you expect to pick up the pieces and, as Eileen says, have a cup of tea even with your colleagues?
Yeah, I feel like it's still very hard to know at this stage. I mean, as it stands, like, you can travel to the state. If you do travel, I guess it has to be essential travel only. Like, where I worked, it still hasn't reopened. And then I also, like, lost my office job just before I came back as well. So I'm still kind of in limbo, not sure when I will return, if I actually will get to return, and if I will be moving back there again.
Could you see yourself working remotely, continuing your work with the project from a distance, from Ireland?
Yeah, possibly. As it stands, like, I am, like, you know, still working on stuff, still kind of working on different, like, interview edits and trying to reach out to people on social media to source more interviewees. So yeah, we'll see how it goes.
And Liza, how vital has social media been? Because it's been a long time since I studied history in university, over 21 years at this stage, and social media certainly wasn't a part of it at the time. So how vital is it as a means of sourcing it and stories?
Yeah, I think for us, it's extremely vital, definitely to keep the project going and to get the word out about the project and find more interviewees. You know, Eileen obviously did a wonderful job in Woodside because she knows people and she has those connections and that sort of word of mouth. But I think definitely if you want to reach some of the younger generations, they're constantly on social media. So definitely sharing our page and, you know, posting about our page and posting about our project and keeping the word out that way, I think will help us to continue to get participants, particularly the younger people. I mean, it's crucial, I think, at this point.
And what kind of themes are you seeing on social media amongst younger people? What's bothering them the most about it? Is it a mix of people who've returned to Ireland saying, we'd love to get back? Or is it just general frustration with the lockdown or anxiety about the loss of jobs? Where would you say the mood is at? Or maybe they're just all talking about the election at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are much more willing to connect. And I think on social media, you know, you've seen all types of explosions of, you know, people, especially like the Irish arts and like Irish music and stuff like that. They're, since they can't perform live, that's like a big, you know, integral part of like being performing for them and stuff like that. So they've created, you know, new websites and stuff like that. There's one called Tune Supply, who I found out through an interviewee named Brenda Castles. She's a concertina player. They've done like 40 Irish concerts, traditional music concerts. So that, I was very impressed by that. You know, that's a younger generation doing something innovative to keep the Irish arts going. I think social media is definitely a big part of this whole COVID-19 lockdown and pandemic. That's how people have continued to connect. And I think it's going to continue that way, you know, as long as we're sort of on pause and in quarantine and not able to socialize other ways. I think social media has really helped people to connect. And also Zoom, you know, Zoom has been a big part of our work. You know, we conduct our meetings for the Oral History Project on Zoom. I've interviewed people on Zoom. So sort of all these technologies, Skype, I've used FaceTime, you know, all the phone as well. So we've really used new technologies and new ways to reach out to people. But I think we've done a great job and we're resilient. I mean, at first, I think we sort of thought we were going to have to put the project on pause for a while since we did conduct our interviews in person before. But now it really, you know, we've gone remote and we've been successful. So I'm really happy about that.
Finally then, and because we have to wrap it up due to time constraints at this stage, but I would like to get a sense from all of you maybe as to whether or not you plan on follow-up interviews with maybe in a couple of months or weeks or days' time to see how people got through the period since you last spoke to them, or over however long this lasts? Will there be a kind of a closing, a bookend to the COVID chapter of the Oral History Project, with maybe follow-up interviews to see what people's journey was like during it?
Oh, I definitely hope there can be follow-up. We're in a very strange time here in New York and in America, and there are, we're definitely not in the, you know, in March when a huge, when a huge hospital ship was coming up over the Hudson River, you know, bearing hospital cots, and that was pretty scary. So you know, it's also when you combine it with the protests that have been going on, with the upcoming elections, with the uncertainty about where, if we will spike again, we have flattened the numbers. I think it's another moment to follow up and see where our subjects are, what they're feeling at the moment. I find it kind of an equally interesting time we're in now as we were in April. So I hope to definitely follow up. I hope that Eileen and Liza and Claire especially can do interviews, because the hope persists, but it's with an even greater uncertainty, and not least with where things are going with the economy. And I find it interesting that New York City itself is transforming greatly, that many people, affluent people especially, have fled, and rents have crashed and housing has crashed. And I'm personally a little hopeful that this will bring in a different element again of artists and people who can afford New York. But it's definitely a becoming a different city. And so that aspect would also be interesting to capture with our interviewees.
And Eileen, have they all kept safe and well? I would hope you haven't through the...
I'm sorry to say I've heard a little bit of bad news, you know, which is truly unfortunate. People I would have loved to have had the opportunity to speak to when all this is said and done. And I feel awful for families who have lost anyone during this time. It was very, very difficult not being able to visit people in hospitals and nursing homes, and to lose people during an already incredibly challenging time. But everyone else that I've spoken to, we ended the phone calls with a promise to keep in touch, which I intend to do, to follow up, make sure everybody's doing okay, and continuing to make contact with other people. New interviews, interviewees are always welcome. I hear from people all the time. I have a sister, a cousin, an aunt, whoever it might be, who might be interested in sharing their story. So our aim is to continue under any circumstances. We're doing the best we can, and technology can only help us. And this was an opportunity for many people to get on board with technology they hadn't used in the past. So I think that's promising for our efforts.
All right. Well, I think that's a good note to end it on. And listener, if you think you can help, if you have a story, or you're living in New York and you're an Irish American and you think you could, or an Irish person who's migrated to New York and you think you could help the Oral History Project, get in touch. And we'll certainly put out your contact details on the social media with this as well, and pop them up on our webpage if people are interested in getting in touch. But thanks a million, everybody, for talking to me. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.